Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm a feminist, but when I saw that you'd gone to Lizzo without me last night with your superstar, long-term friend, Hollywood star, fellow Guilty Feminist co-host, Susie Wacoma, who you described as my best wife, I felt deeply jealous and wished you'd had a terrible time.
Oh, no! Just
don't owe me. I'm still wishing and hoping you had a bad time.
Oh, we had such a good time. Really sorry. I'll tell you what, I got a text from her just going, any chance you're free tonight? You're probably not. And I went, do you know I am? And the work I was going to do, I could not do. What is the thing? And she said,
it's Lizzo. And final night of the whole tour.
She'd been invited into a fancy box, though.
Yeah, that's not making it better for me.
Sorry. And there was, like, free drink in the box and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you, Debs.
And then
I'll just sip my tea.
No, I was a plus one. And I did, I was just, you know, sort of doing that wry thing because Susie's definitely one of my closest friends. So when I said my best wife, it was only after I posted that I went, I wonder if anybody else will think, oh, best wife, interesting. And I thought, no.
It's me who thought it.
I genuinely thought, don't have such an ego, Deborah, that anybody else would give a fuck that you're calling Susie your best wife. And it turns out,
yeah,
it was a dagger to your heart.
Dagger through the heart.
Let me pull it out and say you are also one of my best wives.
Oh, equal the wording best wife. Was too careful there. Your politics is too good. You do an I'm a feminist butt because
oh,
I'm afraid I'm on a theme here.
No, I was. The thing is, I have got some I'm a feminist butts from Lizzo, but
oh, I see.
I promised to save them for Susie. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God, what is this?
Because I thought we were going to do them together. I'm so sorry, this really hurts.
Don't touch me.
No, oh no, no. I'm going to plan a really good hen night for you, though. Okay. I've already promised to plan your hen night. And I wouldn't do that if you weren't a best wife, one of my very best wives, would I? Plan the hen night for dreams.
Okay.
I haven't planned a hen night for Susie.
Is she engaged?
No. Not as such.
Will my hen night be better than the last night of Lizzo's tour at the O2 in the fancy box of free booze, Debs?
I will make sure it is now.
Do you think you can get Lizzo to come, or...?
I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what's happened.
Yeah.
You've just significantly upped the ante on what your hen night's
going
to be. Yeah,
because it was just going to be MDMA and bowling in Margate.
It was. To be fair, it's what she asked for. She asked for bowling in Margate. She said just fish and chips and bowling in Margate. She said, I don't want to fuss. Now it's got to be in a private box of the O2. And it's got to be equal to or better than Lizzo. And that's a tough old ask.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
I'm going to... Listen... I'm telling you, I'm going to find something that is great, equal to or greater than. I remember this is my primary school maths. That I'm telling you, your fen night's going to be, it's going to go off. You're all invited. I'm a feminist, but whenever other people went on about how hot Harry Styles was, I used to say, yeah, he's lovely, but he's so boyish. Like, if I were in a situation with him, I wouldn't know whether to snog him or breastfeed him. But lately, I would. I would know.
Oh, which is it?
It's a... I've developed a fetish.
I'd like a kiss on his mouth.
Would you?
Yeah.
But I'd be open to the sort of...
But also, I don't think I want to fall in love. I like a quick kiss on the mouth. I don't think I want to do any more. Maybe like a frolic in a... Like, just sort of like run around a field. Maybe take turns doing piggybacks. Like, it feels quite innocent.
Take turns doing piggybacks. If Harry Styles offered to give me a piggyback, I'd be so self-conscious. I don't want him to piggyback me. Harry Styles, if you're listening... Do not invite me on a piggyback situation. Either way round, you're really big, strong dog. You've got the weightlifting. I would fail on both counts. However, I don't know if it's whether he's morphed from boy into a man or I've just got hornier. Yeah. Something's gone on.
Little bit of both, Debs. I've now imagined him whether or not I could get him right up my shoulders. carry on. I'm a feminist, but when I read that you'd also jumped out of a plane with Susie Wacoma, I thought, oh no, the most exciting thing we've ever done together is stayed up talking past midnight in a nice hotel near Woking. And my
fucking hell. Now I have to organise skydiving
notch,
for 12 comedians.
Yes, except I am scared of heights and edges up high. So I would probably rather perhaps a scuba trip.
Is this hen night now in the Maldives?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Listen, I'm open to it. I'm going to make your dreams come true, baby. I'm a feminist, but... Yeah, here we go.
You've got to make that noise. Someone opens a can, you've got to go. I taught my son that by the age of two.
I'm a feminist, but Gary Lineker. Whoa! Get your principles out. Get your principles out. Get your principles out for that girl. Get your principles out for the girls. Integrity is sexy, isn't it?
Oi, oi. Yeah.
I don't know. I never saw Gary Lineker, and I don't mean to objectify a man who's just doing the right thing.
Absolutely brilliant on Twitter for ages.
I just, you know, integrity is hot. There's no getting around it.
Oh, yeah.
If you're listening internationally.
Oh, crisps.
Yep, no, that's true. He does advertise crisps.
He's associated himself with excellent things for years.
I see. You found him hot because he had crisps before the integrity.
He would carry them around, and there I'd be.
So Gary Lineker, if you're listening internationally, is a footballer / football 30 years I think on the BBC football commentary.
Surely they've heard of Gary.
I don't know, everyone around the world won't have heard of Gary. And he recently responded to a very draconian policy about refugees from this government with a response, and the BBC went, oh, you're not impartial. Why does he have to be fucking impartial? He's a football commentator. He's not a newsreader. He's not an interviewer on Newsnight. Absolutely ridiculous. And so they said, you're going to be suspended until you apologise. And so everybody said, Match of the Day, which is the big football show here, fuck it, well, we're not coming to work either. And the whole, I think the crew and everyone just, well, no, we're not coming in either. And the BBC went, oh, we've fucked up. Sorry, come back. But in doing so, I have mildly objectified, not in a bad way. And the football chant that I was singing is usually, used to be, get your tits out, get
Get
your tits out for the lads.
Yeah.
And I cleverly turned it into get your principles out for the girls. Now, yeah.
It's
does it rhyme?
Very earnest version, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I don't know what else I want him to get out. I don't want him to get anything else out. I don't want him to get things out.
I was going
to
say cock and balls. I was going to say.
But you don't want that.
No, I really don't want that.
I can see.
I really respect him, but he must keep them.
Even before I'd explored, he'll ruin everything if he just starts cutting his cock out much of the day. You'll get me too. One of the only good ones.
I thought a request had come in from a really feminist podcast. No, yeah, I've taken that too far, Tom. Edit that out, because...
He doesn't, though. He thinks it's funny to leave it in. So this podcast is apparently just full of us going, can you edit that out? And him not doing it.
I'm a feminist, but...
Yeah.
When I saw that you had also gone... Not only skydiving and also to Lizzo's final night of a tour, but also to ABBA Voyage with Susie Wacoma. Actually, really glad you got someone else to do that with. Yeah.
I thought, I've really lost them now when they don't let us know. We're like, that's too far. We accept that you were the plus one to Lizzo. We understand the nature of the skydiving. But ABBA Voyage, you've crossed a line, Deborah.
No, that one. Stick it up your arse. Glad you had someone else to go with.
I really thought when they groaned, I was like, oh, fuck, I fucked it. It's incredible.
I have lost a few ABBA fans. I could sense.
No, I'll tell you what. Tom Selinski went, and Tom Selinski, I've never heard Tom Selinski ever mention ABBA. He wouldn't dance to ABBA at a wedding. He's not interested in ABBA. He's just not. He went to ABBA Voyage. He was invited by a mate for his birthday, and I was like, oh, he's just gone along to a thing. He won't enjoy the ABBA Voyage part. He'll just enjoy the friends and drinking to part. I texted him the way back, how was ABBA Voyage? And he went, sell a kidney to get a ticket if necessary. I thought, obviously, that's hyperbolic exaggeration. In other words, he hated it. So I said, oh, was it that bad? Was it? He went, no, I mean it. And he walked to the room and said, you have to see it. You have to see it. So we went, and it actually put me into an existential crisis, because what is death?
What?
Do you know what ABBA Voyage is? It's holograms of the 1970s group, like the 1970s ABBA, but
they're
singing now.
They know who ABBA is. It's holograms of them brought back to life singing.
Yeah.
With a live orchestra.
And what? Here's the thing with it. It's...
Just their songs?
Honestly, it doesn't matter. They could sing Patty Cake, Bacon Man. It is their classic songs, then some new ones. However...
Like, imagine if you got there, like, all the ABBA classics and Baby Shark. I would... I tell you what. Yeah, I'm keeping my kidneys.
Both of them?
Yeah.
I just need to say about it, though. Okay. Seriously, I just need to say, Jess, honestly, it's such an astounding thing. I know you're not allowed to film it, because of course you're not, but I think you should be allowed to film your friends watching it. Because I looked down the row and everyone was like, oh, like they'd seen a biblical resurrection. It was bizarre. And I know, you think to yourself, because I imagined holograms. I imagined sort of like a sort of projected thing. It's like... they're really there. But then sometimes they walk off and they just disappear in fucking front of you. It's in... You just have to see it. I'm not really allowed to talk more about it. I've not. Because I just don't want to spoil it. But it made me question, what is death? And on the way back, Susie and I planned the hologram Guilty Feminist show that would happen after we'd died.
Susan, you did.
But you'll be in it too. You'll be a hologram in the Guilty Feminist. We'll all be. If you don't want to go to ABBA Voyage...
Can be a hologram in the future when you and Susie have passed away, and I can be a cardboard cutout nearby.
No! Oh my God.
Just a couple of holograms jumping out of planes, and you can pop my cardboard cutout out. You can pop it up in that hotel in Woking.
If there's a Guilty Feminist Voyage after we've died or when we're old, you will be a lead co-host in Guilty Feminist.
My corpse, reanimated, will have prestige.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Okay.
Have you got any more?
No.
Have I done three?
Yep.
Great, then we're done. have I done three? I haven't.
Sorry.
I haven't.
God, that's two. Not... Okay. I mean, I'm a feminist, but we just counted to five wrong.
Okay. I'm a feminist, but I promise to never again get in a back and forth with a man on Twitter going, ooh, but also what about men? But only when a woman is talking about women things. But I thought, yesterday, this man was different. And today, I concluded this reasonable exchange that turned into an incredible escalation by writing, I apologise for interacting with you. I'd mistaken you for someone who'd replied in good faith. And then when he said ditto, I added the extremely mature lol.
I think you've played that beautifully.
I know, but why did I bother? Why did I go there? I've really
stopped.
You're
very kind. I've always thought you had an incredible capacity for entering into conversation with people who were fizzing with challenge.
Fizzing with challenge.
You know, I mean, I've got no... you're really good for even trying.
Thank you. I don't often anymore because I just think it was just a waste of time, but... I did, and I ended up, yeah, going, I've mistaken you for somebody who'd entered this conversation in good faith.
I'm sort of tempted to get that on a tea towel, really.
Yeah, I'm so sorry I've mistaken you for someone who's entered into this conversation with good faith. It felt so good to write it. But then I thought it was quite good, mic drop line. And then he went, ditto. And I was like, because you can't think of a good comeback, you've just had to copy mine. So I had to go, lol. And I should have just fucking left it. But lol. I bet he's written back as well. Got to find out.
Should we have a look?
Live from King's Place in London. The spontaneous show presents the Guilty Feminists with me. Everyone's right. Yes, for hosting the costume. And our very special guest, George O'Keefe. Lisa Lee. Talking about Section 28. Oh my God, it's so lovely to see you. I'll never, ever get used to coming in here and just having people sitting together, no masks. You know, I could lick the front row if I wanted to legally. I just love it. I just love it. Even just coming into the building and it being just warm and buzzy and, just loving it. I'm just having a really nice time with normality. I never appreciated normality until someone cruelly ripped it away. And now I do. Can I lick anyone in the front row? Is anyone open to that? Are you pointing at your husband? I don't know why I knew he was your husband. I just knew from the look on your face. You went, he needs a good looking. And I'm not doing it. Done enough this week. Was very much the implication. Hello, welcome. If you're late, I'm in a good mood, and I'll just assume it's you're late because you were doing feminism. And you were needed at a feminist emergency. I love that. I once was doing an LGBTQ+ gig with Peter Tatchell. You know Peter Tatchell? Very famous human rights advocate. And something was happening with Pride. I can't even remember what it was now. But he was meant to stay on and hang out and have drinks. But as soon as he finished his talk, he said to the audience, I'm so sorry. I've got to go and save a parade. And basically, I was like, my God, it's just like gay Batman. It was absolutely... Which, to be fair, gay Batman is also just Batman. So, happy St. Patrick's Day. But did you know that it's also St. Gertrude's Day, patron saint of cats? If anything could be more feminist than patron saint of cats, Gertrude, who none of us have ever heard of, why? The patriarchy. Have we heard of Gertrude of her pussies? No, because we're too busy thinking of Patrick and his snakes. This is how it begins, this is how it ends. So in honour of Gertrude, I thought, I've got to find out if there are any other feminist patron saints. And do you know there are? At least there are, according to a website called Autostraddle. I'm not sure they can be entirely trusted. The title is Radicalizing Cathedrals Way Before Pussy Riot. Meet the top 10 feminist saints. Are you ready? Yeah. Okay, should we start with 10?
Yeah.
Maybe we should start with 5, because obviously it might take a while, mightn't it? And I'm nothing against the bottom 5, which I'm sure are great. Joan of Arc only made 7. Well, this is the thing. This is the thing with your life. You can live it as well as you can and you're still number 7. Number five, feel like David Letterman. Julian of Norwich.
Yes.
Do people know Julian of Norwich? Yes. So I studied Julian of Norwich when I was at university because she was one of the very first female writers and thinkers. And the reason she had to be a saint is because the way in those days women were allowed to say anything was to say, I had a dream. God told me some stuff in a dream. And then people didn't want to go, shut up, in case that had happened. And then they were saying to God, shut up. So it was the only way women could say anything. So it was the God told me in a dream defense. What I love about Amelia Lanya, there was a brilliant play about her, Amelia, is she wrote this incredibly brilliant proto-feminist poem about Jesus, long, long, long poem about Jesus, really funny. And I was like, God, how did she get away with it? Because it's Elizabethan, like Jacobean, like how did she not go down for blasphemy? But she said God gave her the title in a dream. And I thought that's quite clever because she's gone, I wrote the fucking poem, all right? But if God titled it, he must be pleased with it. I mean, women are so clever. Okay, so Julian of Norwich, not technically recognised by the Catholic Church. I don't think that's the worst thing they've done, guys. she didn't ever win the Oscar, but you think she did? You know, that one of those, yeah. She argued that God is both mother and father and that Jesus had both motherly and fatherly characteristics. But, I mean, I've always said this. I didn't say it before Julian of Norwich, because she was born in 1342. But I have said it, because I just think if we are made in God's image, if we're buying into the paradigm, God's got to be non-binary. It's obvious. Claire of Assisi, patron saint of social workers. Another young woman interested in religious life, more interested in religious life than marriage. That's the other thing women did, of course. They became nuns to avoid husbands. Claire ran away from home, cut off all her hair, joined a convent. Now she'd join a rock band. Soon joined by her sister Agnes. She sounds cool too, doesn't she? In those days, convents were rock bands. I think this is what we're learning. Became the leader of her own order. Wow, that was probably quite tricky in those days. Born in 1194, before Julian of Norwich. As an abbess, she was known for her dedication to poverty, and so was Mother Teresa. It doesn't prove anything. She wrote to various abbots and even the Pope in defense of the rule of life, the oldest monastic rule written by a woman. Well, the earliest one that's written down that was recorded and that survived. Most of everything women has done has been destroyed or avoided or ignored. Sorry, don't mean to depress you. It's Friday night. It's Friday night! Do we know how to party or what? Okay, another feminist patron saint. Apollinaria, Dorotheus of Egypt, getting earlier, born in 408. Bloody hell. Patron saint of gender nonconformity.
Yes!
Wanting to avoid marriage. It's a big theme with these saints. She was allowed to go on a pilgrimage instead, while away from home. Imagine saying, I will fucking walk across a continent. I will walk to Egypt. So where she's from, probably sounds like she's from Greece. I'll walk to Egypt rather than have that anywhere near me. I fully get it. I think it's brave and also just common sense. While away from home, Apollinaria went into hiding, donned monk's clothing and lived an aesthetic life, eventually joining a monastery. Lived from then on as Dorotheus, only once revealing their former identity to their family in order to heal their sister. Unsurprisingly, accounts of Dorotheus' life don't mention their preferred pronouns. Yeah, that's probably... Yeah, it was 40... She was born in 408. But I love the idea that someone found a sort of a drawing, a crude drawing of her, you know, innocent, and went, there's no preferred pronouns under this. Which would just be great if underneath it said he, him. He, him, / they. Number two, feminist saint. Quiteria, 5th century, patron saint of Pussy Riot. That seems unlikely auto-straddle, unless you're using Pussy Riot in a different way. There's a lot of dispute about the details of her life. Yeah, clearly. But legend has it that her mother was so ashamed of having no sons that she ordered a maid to drown her 9 infant daughters. Oh, my God. This is a horrible story. I'm sorry. I should have skipped over this one. This is ruining your Friday night. However, I think it's going to have a happy ending. Don't worry. We're going to turn it around. The maid let the girls live, and they grew up to fight against the Roman Empire and their father, who wanted to marry them off to Roman officers. After refusing to marry and escaping imprisonment, Quiteria continued to battle against Rome with her sisters until she was... Okay, didn't have a happy ending, but... Listen, it had a happy middle, because she wasn't... The maid was like, fuck this, I'm not going to kill them. Then she fought, she became a warrior. Then she refused to get married, so did all of her sisters. Then... History doesn't relate. History does relate, but, you know. Oh, the number one. We got a number one. The number one feminist patron saint is... Any guesses?
St. Catherine.
Not St. Catherine. The very famous.
Kate Blanchett.
Kate Blanchett. Very good. In fact, it was Mary, Mother of Jesus. Oh. Very like Kate Blanchett, though. Kate Blanchett would probably play it. First century patron saint of artificial insemination. The writer of Autostraddle says in brackets, I'm probably going to hell for that. While many female saints are celebrated simply for their virginity, Mary's case is a bit more interesting. Unlike all other humans who are considered sinful from conception, Mary was immaculately conceived. This is kind of a big deal. Yeah, yeah. She was born free from sin. It's almost like Mary's proof that there's nothing inherently wrong with being female. Not to mention that she is a kick-ass example of how virginity is a completely arbitrary concept. There's a lot to unpack there. Now, listen, let me just say, I need to know who wrote this, because it's just by someone called Trees. Trees, we need to know who you are. You wrote this in 2013. Whoever Trees is, please write in. We'd love to get you on the show. I'll see if Trees has got more of a name. Trees, no, just a name is just Trees, if you click through. So what I thought we could do is just... are there any patron saints that you think should be and aren't currently? Or we don't know if there are or they aren't, but just a suggestion, because I thought I'd send a little DM to the Pope afterwards, because his DMs are open. No, they are, they are. You can tweet the Pope. So I thought I'd put forward some suggestions. Any patron saints of, and you can have anything, you know, like it's, you know, there's one for horses, there's one for lost things, there's one for, you know, fingernails probably. What patron, feminist patron saints you wish there were but aren't? Sorry?
Ada Lovelace, patron saint of computer says no.
Excellent, excellent.
Hedy Lamarr. Wi-Fi.
Patron saint of Wi-Fi. Oh, that's good, that's good. I'm fascinating that you're actually putting forward candidates. I was just putting forward categories. I was going to leave it to the Pope to find, because I thought he'll have a team, to find... appropriate people. Like, I was thinking the patron saint of the pay gap, right? I thought we would need that. And then they could, you know, they'll have a team on it, I'm sure. They can interview candidates, that kind of thing. Or we could put forward people here. Who would like to be the patron saint of the pay gap? Anyone? Does anyone think they have a particularly remarkable pay gap? Yes, you do. What's your name?
Heather.
Heather. And Heather, what's your claim to the patron sainthood of pay gap? For 4 years, you battled for a regrade. I'm just saying it into the mic so people at home can hear.
And with all male managers.
All male managers.
Finally got a female manager.
I've
got a 20 grand increase.
You got a 20 grand increase, but you fought for 4 years. So could you say your first name and maybe the area you're from, either you're born or the place in London you live now or whatever? So you are the Heather of Woolwich, the patron saint of the pay gap.
Yes.
Putting it forward, Heather of Woolwich. Yes, what's yours? Did you put your hand up? Oh, you were just going like that. Oh, that was just like a spiritual, like, it was sort of an open palm pump for Heather of Woolwich. I thought you were going, I've got one. Has anyone else got anything else they'd like to see beatified? I think beatified is the bit before sainthood, isn't it? Oh. Are you open? Someone in the audience just suggested you have to die to be a saint. There are no living saints then. Oh, no, you're right. Well, how about we do a retrospective, like Heather of Woolwich, when she dies, becomes. Okay. And listen, we're not doing anything to hasten that, although it would be good for the podcast numbers. We don't want that.
What about all saints? What's that?
All Saints.
All Saints. Well, not the shop, though, the band, presumably. Yeah, the band. Yeah, yeah, excellent. Anybody else got what candidate of a category? Patron saint of?
Patron saint of having your ideas nicked by a guy.
Having your ideas nicked by a man. Yes, that's good. I would love that because you're meant to be able to kind of quickly go, oh, you know, like that. Help me find my cat. Like, you know, you're meant to be able to do that. So patron saint, so when your idea is nicked by a man, you're meant to sort of reach out to the patron saint and she's meant to send you a bit of either power or comfort or something like that. Anybody think they're a good candidate for that? Has anyone had their ideas nicked by a man and found a way to grapple them back? Everyone. Yeah. Everyone. Any techniques for grappling your idea back? Oh, thank you for agreeing with me. That's good. That's really good. I've heard of a really good one, which is you have to do it in teams. It's a team sport. If you see it happening to one of your female colleagues, you go, yes, actually, what you've said, Graham, is great. And when Sarah first pitched it, and I'm so happy you're running with it, and if they've added a bit, comment on the bit they've added, and then reiterate to Sarah's idea. Apparently, it was the young think tanks and consultants and advisors of Obama's that came up with this. They call it shine theory. So maybe they should be, when they die, the patron saints of men fucking off. Hashtag not all men, but lots of them. Normally I go, look, it's a minority of men, but it's really not. But in that one, it's not. It's a majority, and if you don't do it, you just think you don't, you're the worst. Do any men think they don't do it? Do any men think... Just shout out if you think, I've really worked on it and I don't do it. Just shout out if you think you never did it. Just shout out if you... So all the men in here do it. And I'm happy about that. You're like, I do it and I'm all right with it. I'm all right with it. That's just, you know... I steal equally from both men and women. What an equality champion. What an equality champion we have in the audience.
I also steal equally from men.
All right. This is the Guilty Feminist Podcast. Woo! If you've not been to a podcast before, it's like a TV or radio recording, except there's... Okay, it's like a radio recording. This is... If you don't know what you're at, it'll become apparent. Would you like to meet my extraordinary co-pilot for this evening? Woo! Then put your hands together and make incredible whooing noises for the wonderful Jessica Foster-Kill!
Lovely business what? With the saint stuff.
Well, that's really, do you know what? That. I asked the question and then they just came rolling in. Right. How is that not incredibly funny? Are you too young to understand that joke? When the saints...
Thank you.
The saints come rolling
Thank
in.
You,
Maybe I should have done it.
Marching.
Oh, there's
yeah,
marching.
That's it. Your saints are coming.
That's why it didn't work. I thought it was you and it turned out to be me. But I can admit that. I'm going to do it again. And could you fake laugh? Okay, everyone be quiet because otherwise the audience at home will know. This is why you come out to the live show. You see how the sausage is made.
Okay. See how it's rolled. I mean...
How it marches.
Marched.
Okay, all right. I just threw out the question. Sorry, I got to that. Yeah, I just threw out the question about the saints, and then the answers came marching in. Boom!
I'd drop the mic, Debs, if I had less respect for the venue.
Unfortunately, that will not play on the podcast because that an audience would titter at that; they wouldn't cheer. So, could you do a medium-sized chuckle?
She's making you do it again.
I'm not going to do it again. I don't need to do it again. I smashed it. They need to do it again.
Right.
So I'm just going to say 3, 2, 1, and you're going to do a medium-sized appropriate chuckle for that joke.
I won't do a noise that ruins it.
If you could have, because it's a little punny, one person could groan. One person only. What's the name of the man that steals other people's ideas? What's your name? What's that? What? Dan. Dan, you are the only groaner. I'm giving it to you. Like you've heard it and you've gone, oh, an old song, a bit of a, you know, everyone else finds it funny, but not so funny. There's a cheer, anything like this, just a medium-sized chuckle. Okay, ready? 3, 2. That was perfect. That was smashed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was smashed.
Yes, appropriate amount of laughter for the third attempt at laughing the pit.
Do you think other comedians know about this? About you can conduct the audience to laugh?
I think you're the only one I've ever seen do it.
Because I think people.
I love it.
I think I've got it. I think I should paint this technique.
Bloody nips on you, Debs, to be like, let's go again. You can do better.
I think I can paint this technique.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah, because if other comedians found out that they would have to work a lot less hard, if they could just do a bunch of ordinary jokes and then retake the laughter. Yeah. I suppose that's what sitcoms do, isn't it? That's what they do with canned. That's what canned laughter is. Yeah. I think I'm reinventing canned laughter live.
And then going, I think I could patent this. I'm a feminist and.
Okay. All right. Hello, anyway. Jessica Foster.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, and I'm loving that you're wearing your Girls t-shirt.
Thank you.
But it says, what does it say? Girls, gays, theys.
Oh,
I've ruined it. Let me do it again.
Oh, God.
I'm kidding.
Oh.
Okay. You were genuinely worried there, weren't you? You were like, oh, my God, she's going to say everything twice. This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which...
Undermine them.
I'm Deborah Frances White. With me is Jessica Fostercue, and we are talking about Section 28, but very specifically through the lens of a new film called Blue Jean, which is absolutely incredible. If you haven't seen it, you must see it.
Yes.
I insist, otherwise we're not friends anymore. Are you ready for some stand-up comedy? Woo! Then please welcome to the stage my best wife. Yeah! The one, the only, the incredible Jessica Fostercue!
Hello, these will be some short, very recent thoughts. Okay, so I had a terrible revelation recently in the sense that I've realised that I have been mistaking... Oh, I mean, I'm 39. For a long time, I have been mistaking... the desire to get absolutely cunted. Do you know what I mean? Like, for example, like you had a big project has come to an end. Everything's signed off, sealed, it's done. The job, like, there's been high pressure, high stakes. It gets sent off. I get flooded with a feeling that's like, let's go. I've mistaken the desire to get absolutely munted with what has turned out to be just normal physical human thirst. Yeah, I had some big jobs come to an end and I was like, whoa, I won't do one drink. Or if I do want one drink, I want it to be 90% gin. Like, I want a big drink, I want a nice big drink. But I was on my way to work, I was going to be driving to work. That's not very 2023. I want a big drink. Stopped to get some petrol anyway. Sorry, planet. Got a Fanta. Did the job. That's a worry. Very new thoughts, remember, be kind. I was writing a joke, the punchline of which, this is going to upset some of you. I was writing a joke, the punchline of which was Bowden Tankini. And I thought, you know what, I'm a conscientious comedian, I don't want to write the joke, I need to check, you know, I need to know that the item exists in the world. So I Googled it, long story short, there was a sale on, now I own a Bowden Tankini. Well, actually, it turned out, I thought, God, it is bloody cheap. A friend, I put this online, and a friend, a young friend in her early 20s, Italian friend, actually, started saying, what are you like, what even is that? Blah, blah, blah. What have you done? And I thought, fuck her. You know, I'm going to look up the order and check and show her it. Because actually, I think it was really nice. And I'll show her a picture of it, and she'll be like, yeah, fair fucks, actually, because that's so sexy. Not frumpy at all, like that. Anyway, I looked at the order, turns out I just actually bought the pants. So that's not, that won't, I won't feel as frumpy like that, will I? Not with these old boys dangling loose. Dangerous, if anything, wouldn't it? Them all flinging around all everywhere. Be like one of them wankers with their fireballs at a festival. painful though, not very practical. Eventually, I'm hoping they'll get to a length of my tits where I can sort of flop them both over one shoulder. Or the end game, really, is to get, if you are just going to buy the pants, get some with pockets in and get boobs long enough just to sort of tuck them in there. But what tickled me on reflection was like, why did my Italian friend not know what a tankini was? I think we've been diddled here, actually. I think what's happened is that the UK version of Mad Men, some ad agency, it's going to be a man, isn't it? He's going to be called Stuart. He's going to be all, he's going to be of pink hue. He, at some point, has gone, I know exactly how. Do you know the man I mean? Have you met him? Yeah. He played rugby at school, but like mainly for the puss. He said, that's him. But he at some point has gone, I know exactly how to target women called Linda and Fife with a product. Just pop eenie on the end. And someone will have gone, well, surely not a tank. They're like, yeah, tankini. They'll think young Italians are buying it. Well, Linda and Fife, young Italians have never heard of it. If you don't believe me that they're doing this, case in point, Paolo Nutini. I'll give it a matter of weeks before they're rebranding it as ITV Neat. I've had a really exciting thing happen, actually. This is a bit more reliable, hopefully, a stand-up, so you can all relax. Fashion has come to me. It keeps happening. I don't know why anyone goes out of their way to go to fashion. It's a waste of your time. Do you know what I mean? Like, actually keep up with fashion and go and buy things that you think are fashionable. If you stand still long enough, it comes to you. All you got to do is stay in one place. Remember a couple of years ago, dungarees came back in. I already had them on. Yeah. Well, it's come my way even more now. Like not just clothes, actual body. Do you know what's fashionable right now that I've always had? Great big fuck off scruffy eyebrows. Yes, please. £50 people are playing to go to someone and have them scruff their eyebrows the wrong way and glue them in place there. £50, laminated they call it. Fuck. Yeah, you used to do your own. You can do your own with a prick stick. I was born this way. And my favourite bit of fashion that has ever come to me, ever. Do you know what is right in fashion right now? Great big fat ass. Yes. People are paying thousands of pounds to have bits of their body removed and stuffed into their ass instead to make their ass bigger and bigger. I was born with it, baby. And if you don't believe me, it's audio, so I'm not going to bother like doing sort of a display. But a brilliant thing happened recently. My son, he's 7 now, quite tall, quite strong. He was creeping up behind me. I could sense it was happening. I knew it was happening, so I tensed as well, which helped. He was going to give me a big, big kick up the arse. He did it. Really hurt his foot. That's feminism. And he's recently started beavers. Yeah, if you don't know what it is, scouts for younger kids. It's the beginning of scouts. And if you're thinking, hang on, isn't that a bit like, you know, old fashioned? I was like, no, actually, it's very wholesome. And they have done a really good job of weeding out the nonces. They have done a really good job of making it very wholesome. They haven't 100% eradicated all creepiness from the system. For example, his beavers group is run by 2 human adults who I know full well are called Jonathan and Sarah. But when we are at beavers, I do have to call them Fox and Mole. That's not creepy, is it, beavers? Yeah, so there's a little bit of work to be done. I was trepidatious about beginning beavers at him doing it because I'm agnostic, but his dad's quite sort of ferociously atheist. And they were like, well, isn't it really goddy? And what's interesting now is to make it more inclusive. You can do different oaths. You do like a swearing in oath when you join Scouts. And now you can do different ones for all different types of faiths. And if you're agnostic or atheist, you can basically do one that says, I promise to be kind and give a fuck about the planet. I don't think they say fuck, but it's a nice oath. I'm not a brilliant parent. Luckily, my son witnessed one. My friend Sam's a really good parent. My son was able to witness his friend be parented well. And he could hear their parents saying, so when the prayers are happening, if it doesn't mean anything to you, the best thing to do is to just sort of be respectfully quiet. And I didn't know he'd witnessed that. He'd taken that, my son, and him being him, he'd sort of put his own spin on it. He said, oh, I've don't worry, by the way, about the prayers. Tell Daddy not to worry about the prayers. I went, well, you know, it's up to you. What are you thinking then? He went, yeah, I know exactly what I'm going to do. To be respectful, but because they mean nothing to me. When they do start doing the prayers, I was thinking, oh, great, he's going to say it. I'm just going to listen. He went, as they start speaking, I thought I could go, blah, blah, blah. No, you can't. Please don't. That's it.
Jessica Foster, everybody! That was brilliant. Can I just ask a question?
I wouldn't say brilliant. The very early beginnings. Is no. The question cut out the nonce bit? You'll get complaints.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Is the
just
is
the word?
Young, is the young scouts in the UK really called beavers?
Yeah, they're beavers. 5 to 8 year olds are beavers. Then when you're 8, you become a cub.
But no,
and
I
then
remember
I don't know
Australia.
What I can't remember what age you become a scout.
In Australia, we had cubs and scouts, but for obvious reasons, we didn't have beavers.
Oh, Debs, my university football team,
Mingers.
Mingers.
He is also a ninja, isn't he? He does ninja class, doesn't he?
Yeah, not Minger. He does, he goes to ninja school, yeah.
Do you know what I mean, though? Like, beavers is...
2-year waitlist for ninja school. Right, love. Sorry. Yeah, beavers sounds like...
I'm not trying to get into ninja
it
school.
It sounds... Yeah, beavers is... what's funny is beavers another word for vagina. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, and they're small children.
You wouldn't call it... Yeah, this would be... Yeah, yeah, you wouldn't call it muffs or...
No,
yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, actually, when I went to Girls Brigade, I did Girls Brigade, which is like religious girl guides with extra God, and it was... instead of getting badges for, like, tying knots and doing tents, we got badges for, like, praying and self-flagellation.
Oh.
But...
Oh, God. I thought that was a... Yeah, sorry.
Not really. That was a joke and hyperbole. There was no actual whipping of yourself, but...
Fine.
No, I mean... But we were... There was some... They would call it a mufti week.
Oh, what?
And that's when you come with no uniform. And mufti in the army means
you come naked.
No,
you have naked week.
Not naked.
Oh, I thought you meant you just come with no uniform.
Clothes.
So it'd be funny to call it mufti week and then everyone's got their muff out.
I can just imagine you, as a small British child who'd moved to Australia, saying, "Mummy, next week's mufti week," and they said, "I'm not to wear my uniform." And I assume it's called that because I have to get my muff out, and just coming in naked when all the other kids are just like in home clothes. And you're like,
stunning.
I mean,
it would be. It would be a great. You'd think they're probably trying to help me acclimatise to how much warmer it is here.
There's always jokes about what British people do in Australia. So this is a great one. Someone I know who's British was asked to come to a party and bring a plate. What would you bring?
Well, some food to share.
She had never heard this expression.
She thought she had to bring her own plate.
She thought, well, they've obviously not got enough crockery, and she just brought an empty plate. Oh. But bring a plate is a real Australian thing, and I've never heard anyone say it here. They might say bring something, but like bring a plate.
Bring a dish, you'd maybe say.
Yeah, bring a plate is very specific, and she just thought, well, they've obviously not got enough crockery, and she brought her own plate and her own knife and fork. Isn't that lovely?
But it makes me love your friend because also I've been in that situation where I have said, do you want to come around for dinner? But we need 2 more chairs. We need we've got 8. Bring a fork.
I mean...
Should we just bring a takeaway, actually?
the irony of that story is that my friend's name is Sheila. So imagine being a woman called Sheila, because no woman called their daughter Sheila in Australia, because Sheila's back of the ute, couple of Sheila's back of the ute, go Bush, no worries.
Yeah.
They would not, maybe someone has, but I've never heard of a Sheila in Australia. Yeah. But this poor British woman who was A, called Sheila, so was getting ribbed all the time for being, you're a Sheila called Sheila. And then poor thing brought an empty plate.
Oh my crumbs.
She recovered.
Poor Sheila.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Guilty Feminists. This is Deborah. I'm just briefly interrupting the podcast with some news about upcoming events. Tuesday, the 4th of April, I will be in Sydney and we will be doing a Guilty Feminist Queers of Joy crossover at the Darlinghurst Theatre. All proceeds go to support LGBTQI plus refugees living in Block 13 in Kenya and a Ugandan LGBTQI plus organisation of their choice. This is a really important issue. I don't know if you've seen, but Uganda has just imposed the most draconian new anti-LGBT legislation. And many of the refugees in the refugee camp in Block 13 in Kenya are from Uganda. So anything we could do now to help them, to show them solidarity and support, is going to mean everything. So if you are in Sydney and you can be at the Darlinghurst Theatre on the 4th of April, or you can get there in some way, shape or form, we'd really appreciate the solidarity. If not, follow Queers of Joy and Guilty Feminist on socials, and we will post about what you can do. But also listen out for the episode, which will be coming soon after, to see how you can donate or show solidarity in other ways. And the queer refugees living in Block 13, you have no idea how grateful they are for the support and solidarity you've shown them so far. On the 5th of April, we will be in Canberra and I will be doing a Guilty Feminist episode at the National Museum of Australia with Steph Tisdell, and it's surrounding an exhibition that started at the British Museum about the feminist demonic and the divine. It's an extraordinary exhibition. Lots of other women have contributed to it as well. We'd love you to come and see that exhibition and also come and see us live at the National Museum of Australia on the 5th of April. For tickets for both of these, go to guiltyfeminist.com and click on live shows. Guess what? You can also get tickets now for my play. That's right, I've written a play and it's called Never Have I Ever. It's about two couples and an evening that goes very wrong. It's starring Greg Wise, Alexandra Roach and Susan McComa. It's on at the Chichester Festival Theatre from the 1st to the 30th of September. If you're from Chichester or nearby, please get tickets now. Tickets are selling very fast. And you can also get there from London really easily. I've gone just for a show and come back on the same night. Or why not stay overnight and have some fish and chips on the beach? For tickets, go to CFT. That's for Chichester Festival Theatre, cft.org.uk, and search for Never Have I Ever. If you'd like ad-free episodes and to help us keep the podcast going, you can go to patreon.com/guiltyfeminist. And if you want to support us in other ways, you can give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast for any episode that takes your fancy that you think was particularly fun or interesting. Or just tell someone you know with your face that they should be listening to the Guilty Feminist podcast. Jump on your WhatsApp groups and mention it. And now, back to the podcast.
Our first guest today is a screenwriter and director with a particular fondness for convention-defying female-led narratives. She is the writer and director of the BAFTA-nominated Blue Jean! Which tells the story of a closeted teacher forced to live a double life due to Section 28. Please welcome to the stage, Georgia Oakley! Hello, welcome to the stage. Come take a seat. Thank you so much for coming, Georgia.
Welcome.
She is joined by a film and TV producer. Blue Jean marks her feature film debut. Please welcome to the stage, Helen Cifra. you so much for coming.
Hello.
Please come and take a seat. Our final guest is a former school teacher and has published books on equality, diversity, and inclusion in education. She is the co-founder of Courageous Leaders, is on the board of LGBT Ed, and has been awarded an MBE for services to equality in education. She was also a consultant on Blue Jean, and one of the teachers who inspired the story. She is, in fact, Blue Jean. Please welcome to the stage the incredible Professor Catherine Lee. Thank you, Catherine. Come take a seat. I'm going to push my seat out a bit so we can sit a bit more horseshoe so we can all make eye contact so we're not like soldiers in a row. I want to read out a few reviews of Blue Jean. From Variety, quietly searing British debut. From Attitude magazine, 5 stars, deeply human. And, oh, fuck.
No one said that.
From One Room with a View, Rosie McEwen is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And from The Telegraph, 5 stars, a slam dunk masterpiece. And what I will say about that is they've come around, haven't they? Because in the 1980s, that would have been one of the very newspapers that would have been going, "Get, you know, children are so impressionable, we don't want this mentioned in the classroom." And now there are articles in The Telegraph about trans people having to hide their identities for exactly the same reasons. And you can almost track it headline for headline from the 80s till now. So I am going to make a great big old suggestion, The Telegraph. Instead of having to wait 35 years to get your fucks in a row and wake the fuck up and go, oh, gosh, lesbians are human. And then 35 years later go, oh, are trans people human as well? We hadn't figured that the fuck out. Maybe watch Blue Jean with that lens and start saying that shit now. Get ahead of the curve.
Yeehaw!
Which one of you would like to sum up what Blue Jean is about? Because I want you to put... We've both watched it and absolutely adored it.
Yeah, this is absolutely amazing.
It really actually is very good. As the writer-director, what about you, Georgia? Would you like to tell us... What would you like the audience and the listeners at home to know about Blue Jean?
Blue Jean is set in the late 80s, and it tells the story of Jean, who is a lesbian PE teacher. And it's set against the backdrop of Section 28, which, for those of you who don't know, was the law brought in by Thatcher's government that said it was illegal to promote homosexuality in schools and local governments. And the story is a kind of portrait drama of this one woman, and it interrogates her life and choices at that time.
By promote, that meant, you know, it couldn't be known that a teacher was lesbian or gay. They couldn't mention that a composer in music class had a same-sex partner. Like, it was just don't talk about it.
All conversation and support and openness suppressed.
Yes, it created a culture of silence, essentially. But it's interesting that you bring up the word promote, because there wasn't really an understanding of what that meant, obviously. Mm-hmm. But nobody wanted to ask, because the point was that there was a feeling that if you were to speak out about this or speak at all about this, that you would lose your job. And, you know, many of these women that we interviewed weren't out in their lives anyway, so it was,
And our lead character, Jean, she at one point says, like, I'm going to lose my job if this comes out. And that was a very real risk, because then it's like, oh, well, you must have been promoting it, because otherwise how would everyone know? And you're going to be influencing these girls, and she's a PE teacher, so there's sort of, you know, girls having showers, and it's all this, you know, girls who in the school who are, of course, themselves young lesbians or bisexual questioning, and the tension of every room she's in is really, really palpable, because just her very being is posed by the government as a threat to this space, and her love for teaching and her love of children and the teenagers that she's educating. There's this constant shadow over it, this fear of what if this comes out, or what if it seems as if I am encouraging or coercing or grooming, and just being yourself is terrifying all of the time. It's very, very, very brilliantly done. Helen, what made you want to produce this story?
Well, I was already working with Georgia at the time, and we wanted to make our first feature together, so it was It was just when I found out, Georgia found out about Section 28 5 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Found out about it 5 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't know about it?
Back in 2018, when we started making this film.
I didn't know about it. When I read that you also hadn't known about it, I felt better. I'm learning about this, like, horrific
Were
of history.
You not born when Section 28 was in play?
I was at school for most of the time that Section 28 was in play. It was repealed in 2003 in the UK, and I was at school until 2006. But because of that, because of the culture
was
of silence...
Was it only repealed in 2006?
2003.
2003, really?
So was it? The entire time we were at school, yeah.
Wow. So even though it was enacted...
2000 in Scotland, just to...
2000 in Scotland.
It was a few
Scotland's
years
ahead. Yeah, always.
As usual.
But you didn't know about it, even though you lived through it.
Exactly, yeah. Ellen and I were working together, and we'd been talking about internalised homophobia and the idea of the kind of performative element of self, how we can behave differently depending on whether we're at work or... with our families or with our partners. And around that same time, I stumbled across a newspaper article about Section 28, and I hadn't known anything about it. And I was struck by the sort of image that I was presented with, which was this article about these women lesbians who had abseiled into the House of Lords during the debate on Section 28. And for a while, we were going to make a film about that. But we went to meet those women, who were amazing. But yeah, it was thinking both about how that law must have affected my life without me having known about it, and then thinking about what it must have been like for a teacher at that time. It was kind of the two things that drew us to telling that story.
How did you find Catherine? How did this work? How did you...
Catherine?
Yeah.
So it was a weird thing. We were doing research when we read essays by teachers. Mm-hmm. And then we met one other teacher who inspired the film through reading those essays. But Catherine, we chatted to someone called Sue Sanders, who's one of the founders and chairs of LGBT History Month. Mm-hmm. And she actually introduced us to Catherine. And so I think I just emailed you, called you probably, I can't remember. And I said, you know, like, hey, we're like two young, you know, late 20-year-old women who have never made a film, and we're going to try and make a film about this very niche subject matter that at the time we were told constantly no one cared about. And so we're like, can you share your story with us? Because we're not from that time. I mean, I'm French, so like obviously I didn't know anything about it. And then Catherine very kindly, we got on a call with her, and I think it was one of the founding moments for us, because of like, yes, this is really the story we need to tell, because there was so much emotion and guilt and just so much that was still there 30 years later that we felt that, we had to tell this story for her and for, you know, for like the new generations, like our generation who didn't know about it, to find out and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Well, it very much is happening again in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
Catherine, you lived it.
I did.
Yeah.
Were you a PE teacher?
I was a PE teacher, and I was a teacher for every year of Section 28, all 15 of them.
Christ.
She was a netball consultant on the film as well.
I was.
Oh, wow.
She's
to make sure that the netball coaching
in
it was on point.
And she's
there was
in the
quite
film.
A lot of really technical netball stuff in there, actually.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's
attention to detail.
You know the teacher of the other school during the match?
Yeah.
That's Catherine.
It's me.
I'm going to tell you something, Catherine. I believe that being the netball consultant on a film about Section 28 is what the young people call peak lesbian.
Oh, you've
made
I
hope
my
you got
night.
A separate I'm credit.
Yeah, achieved peak lesbian. I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think patron saint.
Of netball consultants.
Saint of netball lesbians. And, you know, listen... You're doing the Lord's work, and your reward will be great in heaven.
Thank you.
So, so can you just tell us some of your lived experience of what it was like to be a young teacher during this time?
Yeah, I mean, it was terrifying. I started my teaching career in 1988, and Section 28 arrived in 1988. And just as Georgia said, it was a complete era of silence. And the wording, looking back, of Section 28, you know, we couldn't promote homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. We didn't really, none of us knew what that meant.
A pretended family relationship. What do they mean by that?
We didn't know.
Still don't know.
It's just a deliberately obscure wording so that they can just go, it's that. Yeah.
Absolutely. So all of us that were teachers, regardless of our sexuality, didn't know how to stay the right side of Section 28. So we were very cautious, and we didn't, you know, those of us that were lesbian and gay at the time didn't talk about our personal lives at all, got into the habit of being two sentences ahead of ourselves, you know, flipping those personal questions as quickly as you can in the classroom and in the staff room as well, turning a blind eye to homophobic language in the corridor if you heard it, in the way that you would, you know, I certainly would have pounced on any other sort of language if I'd heard it. So, just literally spending at least 50% of our energy managing that bit that is where the personal and the professional collide. And always fearing that somebody might see you outside school and you might lose your job.
Did teachers lose their jobs, or was this a sort of threat that lay over you that you were frightened, or do you know any cases of it happening?
No teacher was prosecuted under Section 28. No teacher did lose their jobs. I'm aware that teachers were moved on. Back in the day, state schools belonged to local authorities. And so if a teacher was out or very obviously gay, they may get moved to another school on the auspices of helping out another department. But no, nobody was prosecuted. And looking back now, you know, the wording was so vague, and you know, I think Section 28 was unenforceable, but we didn't know that. No. At the time, and I think one of my experiences of being on set during Blue Jean was to actually see what a waste of energy and the regret that comes with being so small and timid and fearful for 15 years.
It's designed to do that, really, isn't it? Because a democratic government doesn't really want in the papers gay teacher arrested and blah, blah, blah. They don't want that. The same as what's happening with your drag bands in America right now. What they're doing is going, be scared, be smaller, you've got too big for your boots. What is drag? Like, if I wear, you know, at some point in history, if I wore trousers, that was drag. Women were arrested for wearing trousers in the past. So it's sort of like, well, what's the line of that? And what's glam rock and what's drag? And we sort of know and we see it. And it, but it's designed to just make people frightened. So there's, like in Florida, they're saying, well, you can't serve alcohol where there is drag. So, of course, that just means they can't really ban a man wearing a flamboyant shirt. But they can say, you can lose your liquor licence. Well, what does that mean? Of course, bars and pubs can say, sorry, we love the drag brunch, we can't afford it. We can't afford to close down and all our staff will lose their jobs. And I've got three kids in school and, like, I'm really sorry, I'd love to support the drag brunch. We've always loved it. But now it's to frighten and diminish, isn't
it?
Yeah. So this is so relevant. Was this one of the impetuses, Georgia, for you to tell this story? What was the impetus?
The fact that it's still so relevant today.
Yeah,
I mean, when the year that we started developing the story, the No Outsiders, I think it's called, when they teach primary school kids, it's on the curriculum, teaching primary school kids about different types of families.
Yeah.
And they've been trying to bring that in for 30 years, and then it came in 2018 when we had just started working on the film, and there were protests up and down the country with kids being kept out of schools because parents didn't want their kids to be taught about different types of families. And I feel like that's kind of where it all stems back to. Same with the drag, what you were just speaking about. It's this notion that queerness is somehow catching, and that if we tell young children about it or anyone in any school, that they will hear about it and therefore become it. But what that completely ignores is the fact that all children need to have role models. And that was what it was like for the generation of people who were at school during Section 28, is that they grew up without a single role model. Mm-hmm. And that meant, when we started talking about it at the beginning, we were looking around and noticing that there were so many women that we knew who were coming out in their mid to late 20s, not in their, or later, but not in their teenage years. And that, we feel, is a direct sort of the legacy of Section 28, because your teenage years are when you start to kind of figure these things out about yourself. But if you haven't seen that could be a happy possibility for you, and only in the last few years have you had kind of TikTok and Instagram and celebrities coming out, etc. But 10 years ago, there wasn't any of that.
I mean, I needed an extra decade on top of that.
That's the year my son started primary school, and it was fascinating, actually, and terrifying to watch the backlash of that. I felt really excited that he was starting school in the year that they would be taught. And it wasn't just about queer families, but about blended families. Whatever. I mean, my family is very modern and complicated, and I loved the idea that he would be part of the first cohort of 4- and 5-year-olds taught all the different things a family can look like, but was heartbroken to see the backlash. And I think the other thing I noticed wasn't just this thought of it's catching, but also still this really insidious inference that there's something perverse and sexual. I feel like a lot of the protests were like, we don't want our kids taught about anal sex or this. And you're like, well, no one's proposed. It was never part of it that 4- and 5-year-olds are going to get. You know, it's not, that's a different thing. You were just shown about different types. And also, there was so much good stuff in it. You talked about what a good relationship looks like, what kind ways to talk to each other. Mm. And it made giving kids the understanding of perhaps watching how people talk to each other, whether in good, like learning what a good relationship, what a bad relationship, teaching people how to get out of bad relationships. It's fascinating. Mm. It was so much more than the sum of its parts. And the protests just got boiled down to, they're showing them all gay porn? What? But they're doing the same thing with the drag stuff as well. It's the presumption that there's all. It's, oh my God, it's infuriating.
It's absolutely extraordinary. Because it's not like as small children, we weren't taught about the missionary position at the age of 4 just because it was okay to know that was Mrs. Sanders and she had a husband. I didn't ask Mrs. Sanders what she did with her husband. And she never offered to tell me, which I think was poor teaching. Because I didn't know a penis was erect until I saw one in real life. I didn't know.
Okay, that is terrifying.
I didn't know they stood up.
Oh, my God.
Because no one told me. No one told me.
What a horrible thing to learn live.
Just jumped to... jumped to attention. And
oh, my God.
I didn't know. I thought it was fine.
I hope you didn't puke up on it. That is...
No, it wasn't.
I'd be scared.
It wasn't like a Stephen King. It was just a surprise. But like the first time you see a Christmas cracker, that's also a surprise. Oh, no,
I would want to know in advance that it did that.
I didn't.
If you'd never learnt that a hand could triple in size and sort of come at you a bit, you'd want to have known that about hands before you just saw a hand do it. That's not making the edit.
Oh, God. So, Catherine, what was it...
Back to the serious...
I don't mean to scare
stuff.
You, but what was it like... What was it like sort of reliving this through the film? Did it feel like a faithful representation for you? Was it triggering to you in any way? How? Yes, it was. You're nodding furiously
yes.
there.
I shouldn't nod on podcast, should I? Yeah.
Was it like an unexpected erection?
I spent quite a long time chatting to Rosie McEwen, who plays Jean, and she asked me literally about every single moment of my life. And I kept saying to her, but that didn't happen during Section 28, you know? And I kept thinking, why is she asking me about my childhood? And why is she? And then when I was on set, I saw the depth of the character and the way in which she embodied all that. In fact, she's described as a deer in the headlights, and that much is what it was like being in school, and that kind of panic all the time that you are going to out yourself or somebody's going to out you. And to see her kind of relive that and be so small and so timid and so fearful absolutely blew my mind and made me, you know, I have to say, I thought that I've not been involved in anything like this before. I thought I'd been involved in putting school plays on. I thought it might be a bit like a school play. And it was very, very different. I walked into this gym that had been pretty much left alone since the 1980s. And there was all these netballers wearing trainers and things that I remember. So it was very, very sort of evocative. But just seeing Rosie's performance
was brilliant, isn't she?
Yeah, and I half the time I wanted to put my arm around her and tell her that it was going to be all right, and half the time I wanted to shake her and tell her not to be so timid and to be bold and not to be so fearful. And yeah, I think we filmed in the Northeast. I think I cried all the way back to Suffolk in the car without the kind of language to really understand why, which was, yeah, there were feelings that I'd not experienced before, but then a complete and utter joy at the same time, that, and a relief of sorts that actually somebody was telling this story, you know, a story that I didn't think would ever be told. And, you know, I'm so, so grateful that Blue Jean happened, and it's just amazing.
Well, it's interesting, as Georgia says, she said she was at school at that time and she didn't even know it was a law, because it's the absence of something and you don't know what's not there. You can only see what's there. And so, therefore, it's a story that will never be, like, could conceivably never be told, because it's the story of a not a... But, of course, there is for a not to be, there always has to be this underground. Was there anything sentimental about, like, the scenes in that really cool gay bar, the lesbian bar? Was that, did that bring something back? Was there anything kind of sentimental in a good way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, lots of my friends who are a similar age have seen Blue Jean, and we've talked quite a lot about the nostalgia for those underground bars.
Yeah, that, where are they now?
Yeah.
We based it on Catherine's description, actually, because I think maybe we already had it in the story that Jean would run into a student and that would be the kind of catalyst for the story, but Catherine had had an experience very similar to that and then had written it down, like, in the form of diary entries that she shared with us. So we had these diary entries of Catherine walking down the stairs into that space and then seeing a student, et cetera, et cetera, and the fallout from that. We tried to kind of base the bar on Catherine's actual description.
Oh, my God. Well, Jess and I were talking about this.
I do want to go to that bar.
Yeah, I would love that bar to come
back. I don't feel like they exist.
Not so much, but partly there's a good reason for that, which is queer people have been feeling safer in just bars, where they should be allowed to just drink without glares and stares and slurs and violence. But also, I read a book about, or some of a book about gay bars in America and why they've been diminishing, and apparently it's apps. Because now, much like restaurants have suffered from Deliveroo, gay bars have suffered from Grindr. Because you can order in. Don't need to go out and be like standing by a bar and going, oh, do you think I'm sexy? If you want my body, you don't have to go where gay people are anymore. We're straight people. Every bar's a bar where you might meet someone, right? So you were to go. Yeah. So with apps are ruining everything. Can you tell us little... Is it prurient to ask, like, please say you don't want to talk about it if you don't want to talk about it. But could you tell us about what happened when you saw the student from these diary entries?
Can I? Yes. Yeah. Yes. So... we went out on a Saturday night with two other friends, and we walked down the stairs to our local gay bar, because, as you say, they were always underground. They never had windows or any daylight at all.
Was that a case children saw lesbians through a window?
I think
it's like they were blinded by it, like at the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I suppose at the time I just thought we didn't deserve daylight or windows. That was kind of the scent. I'm sorry about that, but that was it. Yeah. But they were a place, you know, they were a real place of community. You saw the same people every week. It was perhaps the only place outside your home, that you could be your authentic self, that you could hold hands with somebody, play pool, do all those, drink pints.
Dance.
All of that kind of thing. Dance, all of those things. I could feel somebody watching our group, and I turned around, and there was one of my my netballers staring over with a friend, and I somehow just raised my bottle of beer at her and just said, you know, hi. And then Jean was certainly much bolder than I ever was, because we left the bar straight away. And I was very fearful that the on Monday morning when I got back to my school, that was run by a nun called Sister Kevin.
Did you just say Sister Kevin?
That seems an implausible turn. Yes. Of all the shocking things I've heard, Sister Kevin is the most shocking.
Patron saint of best names for a nun ever.
Fabulous.
Patron saint of, I'm going to take you
Sister
to a
Geba.
Sorry.
But did the student
the
ever say anything?
What does Sister Kevin say? Climb every mountain, presumably. But like in an innuendo style way.
I waited for Sister Kevin to call me into their office, but Sister Kevin never did, because
their office, was Sister Kevin gender neutral? This has taken a real turn.
Sounds like an incredibly progressive school.
I don't know what you're complaining
about.
What's wrong with Sister Kevin? They them. No. I don't know that you had a difficult time at all.
Their head teacher was.
Sorry, can you just? So you were worried Sister Kevin was going to call you into their office
and tell me, because of Section 28, that I had lost my job because this student had seen me in the gay bar. And in fact, that didn't happen. The student came to see me on the cross-country field and tell me that she was confused about her sexuality, to apologise for spoiling my night, she needed somebody to talk to, and she was so frightened. And I wasn't very nice to her. I put my own kind of fear of losing my job before the support that she obviously needed. And I told her that she wasn't gay. I told her that she needed to just go back into school, that if a mum and dad found out, they'd be thoroughly ashamed of her. Projected all the things about my own identity onto her. And said, you know, don't go down there again. It's a terrible place full of not very nice people. I don't know whether, you know, we talked quite a lot about internalized homophobia, and you can't be a part of something that is a school culture, culture of your workplace for 15 years without you starting to internalize some of that and believing that yourself.
You're also so fearful of promoting homosexuality that you think, I better do the opposite.
Yes.
And that makes me feel physically sick for you.
Yeah.
Like, for you and her. It just makes me feel like crying and vomiting, and which I won't, because, you know, it's a podcast, I'm a professional. But that it does, it really does make me feel that, because I'm just like, oh, this is what power structures turning on the human inside of you, that just, we are all ultimately in the deep down inside of us, we're just frightened, hungry, fucking fearful, you know, all of those, we're just libidinous, you know, scared, want to be loved, want connection. And if they say to you, you're sort of wrong, and you better go down into that basement where there's no sunshine, if you want to be the monster inside of you down there, what are you going to say to a kid? Yeah, do what I just, great life. You're going to go, you're not lesbian, you're not. And it's like saying it to a mirror. But that's you know, now, obviously, you are somebody who is looked to as a senior member of the LGBTQ community, and you are, in fact, such a positive role model. You are a netball advisor on a film about Section 28.
Consultant. Netball consultant.
Sorry, consultant, you're right. Peak lesbian now. Do you know where that girl is?
I haven't heard from her, but my first group of netballers all contacted me after going to see the film and said how much they'd enjoyed the film, but saying, we didn't know about Section 28. "We're so sorry. We had no idea. We're so sorry you went through that. We didn't know, you know." And then told me how old they all were and their lives and at least one of them said I was her lesbian crush, which I really quite enjoyed. Woo!
Well, I hope wherever that other girl is now, that she's found health and happiness and wholeness in an increasingly inclusive society, and we take this as a deep, important, imminent warning for us not to be reversing that which makes people crippled internally and turn on each other. A la Boys in the Band, if you haven't seen that, it is about, written in the 60s, about gay men destroying each other emotionally because they are emotionally destroyed humans who cannot do anything more, you know. And it's this film's hopeful, though, yeah, isn't it, Helen? I thought you said Helen in the dressing room, but then I noticed Georgia calls you like beautiful French Helen.
Helen.
Yeah.
Helen. Okay.
I go by the two here, okay. In case.
Because we can't be trusted. Yeah.
So French and English pronouns, I see. I understand, because you Helen, know we're just going to murder Helen. I get it. Yeah, Helen, it's a hopeful film that you've produced, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. It's hopeful, but it's realistic.
Yeah.
And I think what I was going to say, like, hearing Catherine tell the same story now, what I remember from this story is hearing it 5 years ago, and the way she was talking about it, you could feel a lot more guilt, a lot more emotion, and a lot of shame. And what I find great, in a way, is hearing her tell this story now, I feel a lot more peace. Mm-hmm. So I think having done the Q&As, like having toured with the film like all over the country and throughout Europe, there's been such like positive, cathartic feedback from people on the film, mm-hmm. and I think they get that because it's not bleak, you know. There's a lot of joy, queer joy in the film, mm-hmm. as well, and ultimately it's the portrait of like a very, you know, complex and person who may make mistakes in the film. She makes a lot of mistakes, mm-hmm. but she tries to redeem herself. Like, she can't save the world in 1988 Northern England, mm-hmm. but she does her best, and so in that way, yeah, I feel like it's hopeful.
I think it is.
Catherine, can I just quickly ask?
Yeah.
There's some really fit nipple tattoos in it. Was that like a fashion thing then? In the 80s? Because I've never seen one in real life.
Yeah,
did you maybe add a few?
Yeah,
because they were fit.
Great.
That was smoking hot. There is some really...
Just
to be clear, there is quite a lot of queer joy in the film, and I watched it with my mum. Okay, we're welcome. I'm really going to remember the film.
Was it enjoyable to watch it with your mum?
Yeah. I did get online and order a loaf tin and a new apple corer while there were sexy bits, because it was fucking awkward. Sexy bits were awkward.
I will watch it again.
I will watch it again so that I can enjoy all of it without sort of needing to make a little bit of small talk while the...
Absolutely. Yeah.
I did take my Viv at the time to the London premiere, and during the first sex scene she leant over to me and said, "Well, it's not based on our lives, is it?"
Excellent. So quick lightning round. Firstly, just need to know this, Catherine. You're a professor now. Are you a professor of netball?
No, sadly not.
What are you a professor of?
I'm a professor of inclusive education and leadership.
Sounds like netball to me.
That's peak feminist.
Peak netball.
From peak lesbian to peak feminist.
Peak lesbian, peak feminist, peak netball. So to all of you, is there anything you came to say that you didn't get to say? Lightning round.
Just that Blue Jean is now available on VOD. Video on demand services, and if you haven't seen it, we'd love you to watch.
You've made that sound very sexy. It's VOD.
Yeah. VOD.
Yep, it's available on VOD, video on demand, and do people just put in Google Blue Jean VOD and that'll come up?
I got it off Prime.
You got Prime, did you?
Yeah.
Prime, Apple,
iTunes. Yeah.
iTunes, altitude.film. Is that right?
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything you came to say you didn't get to say?
I'll say that the diaries that I shared with Georgia are now published in a book that I called Pretended.
Pretended.
Oh, I love it. What? Will you be signing copies in the foyer? You should have been signing copies in the foyer. We would all have bought one of those, wouldn't we? Yeah. I can't wait to read that. Diaries from the 80s.
Yum,
lesbians,
yum.
Netball.
Yes, please.
Underground lesbian bars.
Nipple tattoos.
All of the people that thought, oh, I might watch that, should watch that. Sounds like a good film. Yeah, I should watch that, should watch that. Oh, I've also got all that Emily in Paris. All the people who did that, do you know why they're watching it? The nipple tattoos. You have done more than you know here tonight, Jessica.
You're welcome.
For lesbians, for feminism, and for independent cinema. all right. Helen, Elaine, anything you came to say that you didn't get to say?
There's a cool soundtrack as well in the film.
There's a one? Cool soundtrack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there is. And do you have a next project that you're already working on?
Yeah, I do, but this last one took 5 years, so it's kind of too
early. Superstitious to talk about it. Yes.
Well, yeah. Okay,
fair enough. I hear you.
Well, we're excited.
We'll come
to
back
hear
on and talk about that one.
As soon as it comes out, come on, we'll do a screening. We could have done a screen. Do a screening, yeah.
Ooh.
Absolutely. We should have done a screening of this with a book signing.
I won't bring my mom. You can bring Susie Bacoma.
That's one scene. She's from my best wife. Yeah, yeah. There's many besties to me. It's not anyway.
Yeah.
There can be lots of bests. There can be lots of bests. All right. For now, can I just say a big round of applause to Georgia Oakley, Alain Sifra, and Professor Catherine Ling. You have been listening to The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Francis White. Yes, special guests, Georgia Oakley, Elaine Sifra, Professor Catherine Lee. The recording engineer was Chris Sharp. The Guilty Feminist theme tune was composed by Mark Watson. The producer was Thomas Lindsay from the Scotch Nature Shop. Mr. Rachel Graff, and Jim DCO, Zainab Muhammad, and everyone at King's Place, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com. My thing that keeps my phone alive. Itself died a terrible death just before I came on stage. And I'm so nervous that it's going to die and I've got in crucial things on here. So I just wondered if anybody had a juice brick, but I didn't even need to ask because feminism, the sisterhood. As soon as I said I was lacking, front row, it's out, it's in a little case. Thank you so much. Got a cable.
I've got another
cable in case it's not the right cable. Excellent. There's a backup feminist with a second cable. I think it's probably more to do with helping people who aren't rich, white, middle-class people. I'm kidding. I'm not rich. But I'm richer than some people. Hold on. Back up, feminist emergency. Yeah. It is the wrong cable. It is the wrong cable. Sorry. Okay, backup cable. Thank you so much. That's the cable for charging it, isn't it? This is scuppered. Yeah, it always... It's, if you're listening at home, we're not going to explain that. But something remarkable just happened. Hold on a minute. How does this work? Okay, I've understood it. No, it's just... if you're listening at home, it's a sort of multiple... Would you like me to put it in for you? Well, you know I would. It does look a bit like a sex toy, this. It looks like... Thank you. Thank you. It looks like a prepared feminist who goes, we never know where there might be an emergency. Right. Yes.
The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.